This podcast features graphic details of real events taken from letters written by inmates convicted of murder. Listener discretion is advised.
I was a very angry person when I did what I did. All the thoughts came flooding back to me, all the things my son had said repeatedly. Setting their house on fire was the only thing that was supposed to happen. Send a message to leave my son alone.
These are the written words of Ohio inmate number 090811, Shay Waker. They're taken from letters that she wrote to us in 2019.
Yes, I was very angry when I committed the arson.
My name is Ned Parker, and Shay Waker is one of over 2,000 inmates that my colleague Zoe Hines and I have corresponded with in our work as documentary filmmakers.
This is Letters from a Killer, a Podimo podcast. Episode 6, The Unlikely Vigilante.
In our production office sits a filing cabinet filled with letters, the culmination of years of writing to convicted murderers, and contained within them are thousands of stories of life and death. It is from these letters that we select the stories for the documentary films we produce. But in effect, a selection process began far earlier when we decided which inmates to write to in the first place. There are certain stories which, as filmmakers, we've always been reticent to tell, and we steer clear, for example, from telling the stories of murderers who have acted out of some sort of sexual motivation, especially when those are crimes involving children. Childhood sexual abuse is, sadly, a recurring theme deeply embedded in the stories of plenty of the convicted murderers we communicate with, many of whom have been victims of this abuse themselves. And the psychological scars of such experiences are often cited as being a direct causal link to their later violent acts. But our letter writer for this episode is not the direct victim of childhood sexual abuse, and neither is she a paedophile. But her story does feature disturbing details on this theme, and her letters take us into the emotive and complicated territory of vigilante justice, and what can happen when a mother decides to take the law into her own hands, supposedly in defense of her child. Before we explore Shay Waker's letters, let's hear the details of her case.
Letters from a Killer. Case file. The following details are taken from official news reports and court documents. May 2014. 31-year-old Shay Waker attended a Veteran of Foreign Wars Club karaoke contest with, among others, her boyfriend Jason, her landlord, Charles Schaefer, and his wife Karen, and her friend Tim Hall. After getting into a fight with Jason, she took him home and returned to her own apartment, where her landlord, Charles, occupied the ground floor. Still upset from the fight with her boyfriend, Waker smoked marijuana with Schaefer and Hall. The subject turned to child abuse, at which point Waker, who believed that her son had allegedly been sexually assaulted a number of times, became irate. Waker then apparently announced to the group that she thought all child molesters should be killed before talking at length about her ex-brother-in-law, Daniel Marker, who she believed had assaulted her son. She is then believed to have announced to the group that she wanted to burn down all child molesters' houses. Her landlord, Charles Schaefer, apparently claimed to have the solution and asked Shay Waker to enter his apartment, where he showed her how to set off a flare. At this point, accompanied by Tim Hall, Waker went to Daniel Marker's house with a bag of flares. On arrival at Marker's house, Waker stood 25 feet away from the building. She struck a flare and threw it at the house before fleeing the scene. The house was engulfed in flames. Daniel Marker and house guest Tara Lynn Vance were killed. A second house guest, Dana Weatherall, escaped with her life.
So this case file tells the story of the death of multiple people through a fire that Shay Waker started with a flare after a night out.
I think the thing which strikes me immediately about this case is the accusation that the victim, or at least the primary victim, was accused of sexually abusing Shay Waker's son. Do we know if there's any kind of validity to that accusation?
Shay Waker had allegedly reported this accusation to the Fostoria Police Department, who were investigating it. But of course, now Daniel Marker, the alleged perpetrator, is dead, we'll probably never know the truth of the matter itself.
But it does seem that Shay Waker at least believed it. Regardless of however we might feel about what she then went on to do, this is clearly an extremely traumatic thing to have in your head, that your child might have been sexually abused. And especially if the accused lives in the same neighbourhood as was the case here.
Not only in the same neighbourhood, as we heard in our case file, Daniel Marker was also Shay Waker's ex-brother-in-law, the uncle of her son.
In her letters to us, Shay Waker describes the events surrounding the fire that she caused in graphic detail. As ever, this is the voice of an actor, but they are Shay Waker's words, as written to us from prison.
The time the fire started was in the wee small hours of the morning, like 2 a.m. The 25th of May, that night, I went to a karaoke contest at the VFW in Findlay, Ohio, with a few friends and my boyfriend at the time. My boyfriend and I got into a very heated argument that resulted in me trying to commit suicide. Not once, but twice. I went back to the VFW to get the car and go home. Back to Fostoria, 15 miles away. I don't remember the drive back at all. The next thing I remember is dropping my boyfriend off and going back to my house. When we got home, there were a couple of people on the porch. I was still really upset, and somehow the subject got onto child molesters. I made the comment that all child molesters need shot in the head. It went from child molesters to how to start a fire without leaving fingerprints. Then I got a text on my phone to come inside. I went in and spoke to Charles. He asked what was wrong, so I told him about the conversation on the porch. After I let him know what the talk was about, he replied, "I have rolled flares on the back porch second shelf. Go get them and bring them here." So I did. He showed me how to do it and then said, "Go do it." I walked back out on the porch and told Timmy, "Let's go."
One thing that really strikes me about Shay Waker's account and about this evening as a whole is that everything is very heightened. The fight with the boyfriend, the driving home, the blacking out, attempted suicides in the middle of that. And then this discussion, which turns to talk about child molesters. It's a very strange night, all in all. We presume that the VFW is the Veterans of Foreign Wars Club in Ohio. So a veterans drinking establishment, which meant that the night out presumably involved drinking. Shay Waker in that letter says that she doesn't remember the drive back that night at all. So alcohol does appear to be central to what happened. And we do have to be conscious that this was a group of people who were presumably highly intoxicated and also smoking marijuana.
Now, this isn't to say that we're going to blame drugs or alcohol for people committing murders. Intoxication is a regular theme that we read about in our letters, but I think it's of particular interest in regards to this case.
When Shay Waker and the party get back to the building she shared with Charles Schaefer, she explains that she made the statement, "All child molesters need shot in the head." Now, that's obviously a very extreme sentiment, but to be honest, it's not something we'd be surprised to hear somebody who thinks their son is being sexually abused say. It's a gut reaction. What I think we need to pick up on here is the fact that she recounts it as a throwaway comment. And that's relevant to this case, because what we're going to be looking at is the difference between a sincere threat and a drunken outburst.
And that does beg the question, what was going through her head on the night of the fire? What would drive somebody to snap like this? If that is what happened, did she just snap? We're presuming here that she committed the act of arson as some kind of revenge. Was she playing the part of a vigilante? Had she been living with these vengeful thoughts about her victim for a while? because she says that the sexual assault on her son had happened some time before.
As Shaywaker continues to write to us, she does begin to open up more about what was going through her mind as she approached the house that night.
I was venting all the way down the street. Daniel's house was only a block away from where I lived at the time. I stood in front of Daniel's house just looking. All the thoughts came flooding back to me, all the things my son had said repeatedly. Then the visions of Daniel raping my son all those years since he was six came into view. Don't remember exactly when, but I lit the flare and threw it and ran. When I got back to my house, I lay down with my son. The next thing I knew, Daniel's house was engulfed in flames. Only later did I learn that there were three people in the house at the time. Two people passed and one had got out.
We now have a much better understanding of what was going through Shaywaker's mind, what she was thinking about at the time, if we are to believe her words at face value.
For her to write about the visions of her son being raped that came into her mind, you do feel this primal understanding of her rage when you read that.
But we go from that very emotive first section talking about the visualization of the awful abuse that she claims had been inflicted on her son. And then we get to the part after where she's lit and thrown a flare. And for me here, she writes very differently. It's almost kind of detached.
The next thing I knew, Daniel's house was engulfed in flames.
This is a very different voice. It's like a different person. She spent a long time and a lot of effort really taking us to that place of rage and of wanting to avenge her son. And now she's completely detached herself and brushes off the fire as though she didn't really have any control over it.
It doesn't feel to me that it matches the gravity of the event that she's talking about. And that could be deliberate, but it could also be that she's maybe just not connecting with the reality of those events. Maybe she can't connect with the results of the arson in the same emotional way as the thought of her son being abused. But she does go on to write about the people who died in the fire, and there she says that they had passed, which to me feels like a remarkably passive and detached way of saying that someone has died, especially so that someone has died as a result of your actions. And it's not the kind of language that I think most people would use when describing someone who's essentially been burned alive.
Only later did I learn that there were three people in the house at the time. Two people passed and one had got out.
This is the least confronting way of saying that somebody has died at your hands. Shaywaker is clearly trying not to engage with the really ugly side of her crime.
She's been drinking, she's been taking drugs, she's riled up on emotion, she has the difficulties of her son possibly being the victim of sexual abuse and all these emotions raging through her. I think we can empathise to a degree, at least understand how somebody might be pushed to the point of doing something stupid and throwing a lit flare into a building. But the part that I struggle with is that once she's realised that she's done this god-awful stupid act, it seems that she just went home. She got into bed and just let the house burn down.
There must have been a moment after the visions, after she threw that flare, when the fire was getting started. And at that point, she walked away. She's completely omitted any reflection on that.
Don't remember exactly when, but I lit the flare and threw it and ran. When I got back to my house, I lay down with my son. The next thing I knew, Daniel's house was engulfed in flames.
There's certainly no indication at all that she tried to stop the fire. No indication that she tried to reverse the decision or to contact somebody or call for help. And you also have to bear in mind that she apparently has taken no time at all to think about the fact that there could actually be other people in the house. All of that is pretty damning of her and of her story, no matter how open we think that she is actually being with us in the letter.
In retrospect, Shaywaker will say that she never knew anybody was in that house or intended to kill anybody when she threw the flare. But for now, let's stick with how she continues to write about how she felt after the events of that night.
The aftermath and arrest was horrible. I felt so ashamed. taking a life was never my intention at all. Harming anyone was not my intention either. Setting their house on fire was the only thing that was supposed to happen. To send a message to leave my son alone.
In this extract, Shay Waker is saying that she never intended to kill anybody and believes the house was empty. But if we rewind just a little bit earlier, she did say to several witnesses that night, all child molesters need shot in the head.
It is a sentiment that she has admitted to, and it seems fairly obvious that she would say that she didn't intend to kill anyone through her arson attack. And to be fair, throwing a lit flare is not the same as shooting someone in the head, so maybe this was a warning, but she made no efforts, apparently, to see if the house was empty or not. If it was an empty house, then maybe it was a warning, but for me, putting two and two together, I do wonder if she thought that somebody was in there, namely Daniel Marker, the man who she understood had abused her young son.
It's difficult to be sure if Shay Waker simply meant to send a warning message or actually commit murder from the material we have available to us. And we are, as documentary filmmakers, not looking to pass binary judgment on her guilt or innocence. However, the facts do conclude that throwing that lit flare showed some criminal intent. She didn't follow that action up with any response that someone who didn't intend to cause harm might have done. She didn't tell anyone, and she didn't call 911.
Let's return to Shay Waker's letters and hear how she writes about being sentenced.
My first few days in prison were absolutely horrible. Sitting in a place away from my children and family. Having to sit and know that I have two bodies that I have to take responsibility for. Knowing that I took someone's life. It's a horrible feeling. I was very angry at myself for that fact. The fact that I'm responsible for taking two people away from their family. The fact that I took the law into my own hands. Because the law wasn't there to protect and serve like they were supposed to. When I was sentenced to life, I cried for days. Not only did I get a life sentence, but my family did as well. My son got two life sentences. When the rape began, he was only 6 years old. He was robbed of his childhood and his innocence was taken from him. That was his first life sentence. Both my children and the rest of my family got the other life sentence when I received mine. I was so angry back then. Since then, I've been taking classes like victims awareness, anger management, cage your rage, and even parenting classes. I'm trying to become the person I should have been in the beginning. The person I know I can be and one day will be. These 5 years that I've been in prison have really opened my eyes to a lot of things. I'm not so angry with myself. And I have learned to forgive myself and others.
In this extract, Shay Waker mentions the weight that was hanging over her head for taking two lives. She's clearly done some thinking about the impact of her actions on others, but she quickly brings that round to the impact of that night on her family, the impact of law enforcement not acting, leading to her doing what she did. So it does feel like she's kicking the can down the road in terms of accepting responsibility.
Another interesting point to mention is that several of the people in the house that burnt down had hearing issues. They were deaf. Dana Weatherall escaped with her life, but Tara Lynn Vance perished in the fire.
Tara Lynn Vance, Dana Weatherall, and Daniel Marker, the man accused of abusing Shay Waker's son, all had hearing problems. They were disabled. They wouldn't have heard the fire. She may not have known about the other two, but presumably she would have known that Daniel had hearing issues. These were vulnerable individuals, and the fact that she hasn't mentioned that the three people she set on fire were disabled, I find really telling.
It's unwise of her not to have mentioned this to us, because this is the kind of information that we would naturally have uncovered during further research. And that is going to change the way that we perceive her and her original testimony.
We did ask Shay Waker to write about her reflections on the crime from where she is right now, and here's what she said.
I am absolutely not the same person who committed the crime. I was a very angry person when I did what I did. The system failed me as a little girl, failed me as a teenager, and failed me as a parent trying to protect her children. Yes, I was very angry when I committed the arson. The advice I would give to my younger self would be, listen to your parents, stay in school, stay off drugs, and that I'm worth more than I ever thought possible, that I can do anything that I set my mind to, that I am going to be super successful.
So Zoe, what do you take away from Shay's advice to her younger self here?
The first thing that I notice is that we heard the exact same advice from our other female letter writer when asked about what they would say to their younger self. Almost verbatim, except Shay Waker is saying stay off drugs, whereas Stephanie Hohobo was saying stay away from boys. And that's a classic example of the kind of familiarity of certain phrasing and language that we see in these letters. What does jar particularly for me here is the phrase, I'm going to be super successful.
I can do anything that I set my mind to, but I am going to be super successful.
I'd never want to wish anyone anything other than success, but this is somebody writing a letter talking to us about the fact that she took two people's lives, and there's something uncomfortable about the phrasing of success here that doesn't sit particularly well.
There is a certain sort of person who writes to us who, when you're reading their letters, you do feel that they believe that everything revolves around them. And their letters contain less of the regrets about other people involved and the fact that people lost their lives. And there seems to be with Shay Waker here a kind of a dual admission of wrongdoing and mitigation for what she did. And these two attitudes have, for me, existed throughout all of her letters.
On the one hand, she says she's sorry for what happened, but on the other, she doesn't accept full responsibility for it. And from a reader's point of view, that's problematic when it comes to being able to feel sympathy for her.
Let's hear another excerpt from the letters where she does talk about how she feels about the victims now.
I feel sad. Forgiving for what Daniel did to my son. Very apologetic to the other two victims because I did not know. I didn't know they lived there. I didn't know anyone was in the house. I just didn't know.
My question now is, does the phrase, I didn't know they lived there, in reference to the other two victims, affirm that she did know Daniel Marker lived there?
I don't think you can have it both ways. The other two victims were only victims because she didn't know they lived there. Well, that to me does indicate that she knew that Daniel did live there and so was therefore likely going to be caught up in the fire. So there's a dichotomy here. She's trying to distance herself from the additional two victims, which somehow, in the way that I read it at least, makes it only more convincing that she did know that Daniel was going to be there in the house, in the fire, and would likely die that night.
Before we get to Shay Waker's verdict, there are a few other factors to mention that we discovered during our investigations. In our case file at the start of this episode, we heard two names mentioned, Tim Hall and Charles Schaefer.
Tim was a friend of hers, the one that she was drinking and smoking with, is that right?
Yeah, and she actually does make reference to the fact that Tim went with her to the house. So we can presume that he was standing there in front of the house with her while those visions were occurring and when she threw the flare. We found out that Tim Hall was convicted of tampering with evidence and a few other relatively minor charges associated with the night in question. Tim served 2 years for those charges, but the other big conviction here is Shay Waker's landlord, Charles Schaefer.
So this is the Charles that she writes about who provided her with the flares.
I went in and spoke to Charles. He replied, I have rolled flares on the back porch second shelf. Go get them and bring them here. So I did.
Our team wrote to Charles Schaefer, and the absolutely fascinating thing that would have made this a really, really engaging story to transform into a documentary, aside from all the things we've already heard, is the fact that Charles Schaefer has very strong, very different feelings about the crime and the fact that he has been convicted of aggravated murder despite the fact that he didn't throw the flares at the property that night.
Did Charles suggest that he had any prior indication that this was what Shea was actually going to do?
Charles denies any knowledge that Shea Waker was going to genuinely go through with throwing that flare into somebody's house.
Obviously, if you're charged as being party to the murder of two people, you would say that you didn't know that that was going to happen. But he was sentenced to 15 years. So he has gone through a legal process and he has been found guilty of aggravated murder. But for me, it is interesting that she does not mention Charles or the fact that he's gone to prison.
Neither does she mention that she and Charles continued to write to each other after their arrests. Charles actually scanned those letters and sent us the correspondence between him and Shea Waker.
And what was in those letters?
We learnt that that night Shea Waker's boyfriend left with another woman, which catalysed the arguments. We learnt that the suicide attempts were her trying to jump off a bridge twice. We learnt that Charles and Shea Waker had pet names for each other, which brings in all these questions about the nature of their relationship. Obviously, Charles was her landlord, but why was she going in at 3 a.m. to speak to him? And then you've got the fact that Shea Waker, in her letter to Charles, very clearly says, "I know you had no part in it. I know you didn't make me do anything that night. I know you shouldn't be in prison."
This is a man who is serving 15 years in prison for his connection to her and the crime that she undertook. And a crime which privately she says that she knows he had no part of and that he in no way encouraged her to do it. It's a fascinating additional layer to this story and it's quite unique in our experience of writing to inmates.
I think it's time that we heard the verdict on Shea Waker's case.
Letters from a Killer. The verdict. The following details are taken from official news reports and court documents. June 2014. Shea Waker pleaded not guilty by reasons of insanity to the charges of aggravated murder and aggravated arson. September 2014. In the Seneca County Police Court, Judge Michael Kelbley handed Waker a life sentence with the possibility of parole after 25 years.
Here's how Shea Waker reflects on her sentence.
"What I most miss about freedom is my children and family. Being able to spend time with my kids and everyone I love and care about. I miss tucking my kids into bed at night, giving them hugs and kisses whenever I want."
She also reflects on the death penalty in her letter and seems to be asking for forgiveness.
"I'm really not in favor of the death penalty because people make mistakes. And with almost every mistake, there comes a chance to correct the behavior mistake that was made. Bottom line, people make mistakes, and people deserve second chances."
In this episode, we've been exploring the letters of Shea Waker.
"Setting their house on fire was the only thing that was supposed to happen. To send a message to leave my son alone."
Was she throwing the lit flare simply to send a message to the man who she felt was a threat to her son?
"People make mistakes, and people deserve second chances."
If people make mistakes, should they then be given the opportunity to learn from them?
And was the conviction of a life sentence with the possibility of parole the right way for Shea Waker's mistakes to be corrected?
"I am absolutely not the same person who committed the crime."
But if she were released, would this unlikely vigilante show the same tendency towards vengeance again if she felt it was justified?
Next time on Letters from a Killer. Graphic content warning.
Myself and my cousin, we were super tuned because we'd been doing meth for the past 45 days, so we were focused. For me, every sound, smell, everything I touched or touched me, every hair on my body, feels every moment with every flashback of this day.
Letters from a Killer was hosted by Zoe Hines and Ned Parker. and is a Podimo podcast by Transistor Films. Support the show by sharing on social media and following the podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts.